Welcome back to the Sandy and Rania Show. And today we're going to be talking to you a little bit about child sexual abuse.
Yeah, so child sexual abuse has become a national epidemic, and it's something that nobody really wants to talk about. So I think it's an important discussion that should be talked about more.
I agree. The more we bring this out in the open, the less stigmatizing it is for the victims. And maybe they'll be able to talk about it with other people and come forward, because a lot of us child sexual abuse victims keep this quiet until they're an adult.
Yeah, I think that many people may feel shamed, and it may just be a stigma in our country that, you know, once you're sexually abused, it should be, you know, something that's silent or difficult to talk about.
Which really makes me mad, because it's just shaming the victim. And, I mean, would you do that to the victim if they were robbed or assaulted in another way? I don't know why sexual abuse has to bring so much shame.
Right, surrounding it, yeah. And it's just interesting that every 11 minutes, Child Protective Services finds evidence for a claim that a child has been sexually assaulted. I think that's really sad, and it's a pretty high number.
That's outrageous. Yeah. Every 11 minutes, huh?
Yeah, it's crazy. And Detroit has the largest number of allegations of sexual abuse, and Wayne County even has a larger number of sexual abuse cases in Michigan. It has the largest number. And that's where Sandy and I serve. We're at Kids Talk, and we're sexual abuse therapists, and we help kids, basically go through TFCBT and help them process that trauma that they've gone through.
Yes, we see that every day, and it's unfortunate that there's actually a wait list at our field placement, and it keeps growing every day, so that just tells you that it's more and more prevalent.
Yeah, it really is. It's a national epidemic that's an issue, and I think it's important that policy implications are discussed, and, you know, ways that we can better, handle these situations legally, and also through providing therapeutic services, and to just improve altogether the way that we handle these situations.
Yeah, and when we think about, like, who's at risk for this is really one of those crimes that crosses all ethnicities, races, and economic backgrounds.
Yeah. And so I think, like, one important thing to note is that in our agency, we see anyone and everyone, you know, people from all different backgrounds, all different ages, kids who are between the ages of, you know, 2 years old all the way up to 17 years old. And, you know.
Yeah, it's we definitely have a lot of different people coming through our agencies. And that makes it difficult, because it's hard, you know, to know what to do in the case when the child's 3 or when they're 16. I mean, there's a lot of different variables that we have to consider when working with our clients at Kids Talk.
Right. And so, we all have our own reasons and stories why we decided to go to Kids Talk and, dedicate our time there. I personally have worked with, you know, children in the foster care in Detroit. It's called Christ Child House, and those boys were sexually abused, you know, between the ages of 8 years old all the way up to 16 years old. And in undergrad, I was there, just being there with them and providing, activities and things like that, just to make their stay there a little bit more comfortable. But then, you know, I felt like I wanted to do so much more and help them and actually intervene and provide those therapy services, which is what led me to Kids Talk, and to apply there for my internship.
I see. Were you aware of the epidemic of sexual abuse before this?
I was, but I think my knowledge has definitely, you know, grown after, you know, joining this program and, being in this internship. So
for
I'm
sure.
Much more aware now than I was.
Right.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Well, that's interesting, because 1 in every 4 girls and 1 in every 6 boys are sexually abused before the age of 18.
Yeah.
And again, that's the only people that report.
Right.
So
that's
and
probably
that it's
even
really
more
underreported crime.
Right. So, Sandy, what got you into Kids Talk?
Well, I came into this field a little bit differently. I had a personal experience. My own daughter was actually a victim of child sexual abuse, unbeknownst to me, at the hands of my husband, who was her stepfather.
Wow.
Yeah.
That sounds difficult to deal with.
That was really difficult. She was only 11, and I had been married to the perpetrator for about 10 years since she was one. Mm-hmm. So, it was very shocking, and, couldn't believe it. And all the things that I knew about child sexual abuse were, don't talk to strangers, keep your kids away from strangers, don't.
Right.
But never any warnings, really, for somebody that close, because
right.
he was like her father.
Yeah. That must have been really difficult for you to deal with because, I'm sure you trust specific people in your life, and then when that happens, I'm sure at a loss for words and not knowing who to trust and what to do.
Yeah, needless to say, that was a very difficult time for me and my children. A lot of times working with these families, and I've been doing it for a little while now, even before Kids Talk, I was a volunteer at a couple different agencies, child advocacy centers.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really difficult for me when the parents would come in and they would be up in the air about believing their child.
Yeah.
And I could understand that because in my case, it was a forced confession. I mm-hmm. walked in on it, so there was no doubt in my mind that that was what had happened.
Mm-hmm.
But for these people, it's hard to believe that someone you love and you built your life with is capable of such a heinous crime.
Right, right. And I think it's just difficult to even come to terms with it. You kind of want to be in denial and hope that nobody touched, your child
right.
or...
And like I said, I don't know what I would have done. I mean, I'm sure I would have believed my child, but you always have that no way, especially because I've never experienced anything like that.
Right. How did you deal with the legal system, and how was your experience with the legal system?
Well, Rania, let me tell you, the legal system was very, very frustrating. Mm. I also hadn't had much contact with the legal system before that. All I knew about child sexual abuse was basically, I thought, because of watching TV or, media, that mm-hmm. I would call the police would come, they would arrest him, and he'd go to prison.
Right. And
well, no,
that's
not
the case.
How it goes.
Oh, wow.
yeah. Although I kicked him out, and I called the police, I got a restraining order. He was bonded out, so, of course, because of our lovely justice system,
mm-hmm.
he's innocent until proven guilty.
Right.
So he got to walk around the same town as my daughter and I for the next 18 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a long time.
It was really, really stressful.
Yeah.
And then also, anybody that's ever worked in the legal system or knows the legal system is that the wheels of justice turn very slow.
Mm-hmm.
So there's postponements, there's adjournments. And in the case of my daughter, she was going to have to testify because really in cases like this, there's no forensic evidence.
Right.
So she was going to have to testify, and then I was also going to have to testify. But one of the really difficult things was that I couldn't be there while she testified because I was considered a witness.
Oh, so you weren't allowed to be in the room while your daughter was testifying. And that must have been difficult for your daughter to have to deal with, with all the stress and trauma that she had gone through, and to not have her mom be in the room with her when that.
Yeah. And then, we did, my sister and grandparents and her dad were in the room.
Uh-huh.
However, it was still really, really difficult. And then, we'd build her up to try to, you testify and then it'd get postponed, so it'd be another 6 or 8 weeks of waiting. And then also, because of the policies of our criminal justice system,
mm-hmm.
is that the perpetrator has a right to face his accuser, regardless if she's 11, 12, 4, 5.
Right.
And also, his attorney has the right to cross-examine her. So that was really, really, really difficult.
And that's another traumatizing experience mm-hmm. for a child to have to go through.
I found out about the abuse when she was 11, and then we finally went to trial. She had just turned 13.
Mm-hmm.
So all of his family, who she had considered her family because we had been around them since
right.
she was one,
right.
even though they weren't blood related, that was her stepdad.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really hard. His whole family, of course, could not believe that he did something like that, because you don't want to believe something like that. It's heinous.
Right.
How can it? And if you believe that, even for me, believing that my husband had molested my young daughter, my prepubescent daughter, was a really hard pill to swallow, because then how could I ever trust my judgment on anybody else?
How would
I know somebody else's deep, dark secret? So you trust is a really big issue. It's really fracturing, not only for the main victim, my daughter, but also for everybody else.
Yeah, it's kind of like, what do you do after that point, after finding out? Who can you... You probably don't feel comfortable talking with anybody or letting anybody in your home at that point.
Exactly.
So that's really difficult. And I think also another thing that's, you know, an important thing to discuss is the forensic interview aspect of, you know, the prosecute, you know, trying to prosecute the perpetrator and things like that. And, you know, at Kids Talk, at least, we know that the forensic interviewer and the child sit alone in a room, and it's, you know, before therapy has gone, you know, they've gone through therapy. And I think that that's difficult for the child, because sometimes their memories are so suppressed that it's difficult for them to, you know, recall certain things or to just bring the facts
up. And another factor that to consider about the forensic interview, if it's done too soon after the abuse happens, you have to remember that a lot of times these kids have been groomed.
Right.
Okay, so they've, you know, you're going to break up the family, your mom will never believe you. And, you know, I had been with my husband for her whole life, all that she could remember. So for her to go in and disclose to somebody what had happened, even though she had she finally disclosed to me, she's not sure if I'm going to take him back. You know, how does she know? You know, she doesn't know that he's going to be gone. Even though I promised her she never had to see him again, she's a child. She's been groomed. He's been telling her for, you know, 2 to 3 years that...
Right, and that's a good point. Like, during those grooming stages, you're told if you tell, you know, I'll hurt your mom, or if you tell, you know, you'll get hurt, or something will happen, and it's all your fault.
Exactly.
So there's also that aspect of that emotional abuse that that child has gone through.
Really has to be taken into an account, because it's a complex trauma. It's, you know, it's the over, and it's the... grooming somebody to lie and be not truthful. I mean, you have to take that away with you for the rest of your life.
Right.
So, yeah, that was very, very difficult. Most of the time, I don't know if this is a good thing or bad. I want to say I can only speak for my personal cases. Most of the time, there's usually a plea bargain, like there is with 95% of the rest of the crimes. Only 5% of crimes go to trial, or cases go to trial. So most of the time they take a plea, and in my case, my daughter, the perpetrator, was charged with CSC1, which is criminal sexual conduct in the first degree, which is penetration, and the person's over, the victim's got to be under 13, and the perpetrator's got to be over 17. So in Michigan, luckily, that's an automatic 25 years. You cannot be paroled earlier than that.
Wow, that's awesome.
But most of the time, they take a plea. They offered us a plea, actually, at first. They offered us a plea at first, and a lot of times the family want to take the plea because they don't want the child to be traumatized and have to testify in front of the perpetrator, right?
Right.
Tell their story. But
have to go through that.
This person did not take the plea, which I was a little unhappy about, it because it was 5 to 10 years lifetime sex offender, and they were going to charge him with third degree. So I was like, okay, well, she won't have to testify. We can go to the parole hearing and beg that he doesn't get out in 5 years or whatever when he's up for parole. However, he wouldn't take it because he thought he was going to get off, because he's obviously like a psychopath, narcissist, most of them. So we ended up having to go to trial, jury trial, and he hired one of the best attorneys in criminal sexual defense, known for getting people off. So that was scary. Even our prosecutor was like, oh, he's got a good attorney.
Right.
So we had no choice, really, but to go to trial. And she went in, and to be honest, she rocked it out.
Yeah.
She cried. I got to hear the videotape of it. But, you know, the truth prevails.
Right.
I mean, the truth is the truth. No matter how many times she had to tell her story, it's the same story.
Right.
So as much as that hurt, as much as that sucked for her,
yeah,
she at the end of the day, got to people bared witness to what happened to her.
Yeah.
Because for years she had to keep that a secret. So that's
right.
really empowering and freeing for victims.
That is. That's definitely empowering.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you, how was her forensic interview experience? Was it a positive one, or was it something that...
As far as, like, we work in a child advocacy center, so we see that there's, you know, it's a comfortable, well-decorated... Because they used to do forensic interviews in police stations.
Right.
Which is scary, in an interrogation room.
Yeah, that's terrifying.
Right. So we know, like, from where we work, that the rooms are nice and they're child-friendly and the people are child-friendly.
Right.
So when we went in to do her forensic interview, it was like 4 days later. So her biological dad and I took her and my son, who was 4 years older, but who was not abused, in for the interview. And the first time she went in, she backtracked her story. So she said, yeah, he kind of touched me. I can't remember if it was over the pajamas or not. Mm-hmm. So they dropped the charges at first.
Oh, they dropped the charges.
They dropped the charges. Yeah.
And so that's what we see a lot in our office as well. It's just like the kids go in there and they backtrack and
they
don't know what to say and how to say it.
And well, if you think about it, Rania, would you want to go in there and tell your
boss,
you know,
about
something that you don't really know about? It might have even felt good.
Yeah.
I mean, you feel guilty about it, you know, and that's someone you're supposed to love.
Yeah. So what do you do, especially as a kid?
Right.
You know.
So, and they always were, I was very angry.
Yeah.
But I'm sure as could be expected. So I, I immediately put all of us in trauma-informed therapy. So as time went on, about 6 weeks later, they never closed the case. She began to disclose a little bit more to me. And then I said, you have to go in and tell your therapist, because a therapist would be a mandated reporter and would have to call.
Right.
And believe it or not, CPS did not drop the case because they wanted to put him on a registry somewhere, because they have a lower standard of preponderance of evidence or whatever than like the criminal justice system.
Right.
So about 6 weeks later, she disclosed something to me, and I told her, you need to tell your therapist. So she went in and she told her therapist, and then the therapist called the police, and we went in and made another police report, and they rearrested him. And then I wrote a bunch of letters to, like, the chief of warrants, to the prosecutor, demanding that they do something, because what kind of lesson does that teach her, that she was abused all these years, she came forward, she did the right thing, and they're just dropping the charges.
And that's amazing of you to go through all of those steps, and you shouldn't have to go through all of that.
No, you shouldn't.
No parent should have to go through all of that in order to just get the person arrested and prosecuted.
Right, right. But in these cases, it's so, like, you think there's going to be DNA, and there never usually is DNA.
Right.
I mean, it's because it's a long time going, you're not usually catching it in the act.
Right.
If there's been any, like, physical damage done, because she did have, like, an internal checkup.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's you're very elastic down there, so it heals very, no matter what happened.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's really tough. It's really her word against his.
Right.
And, you know, he's got this plethora of people, his family, and, you know, the community that... No way, how could he do that? Because I would have known, you know, and that's what people think.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, I mean, I slept next to the man for 10 years. I had no idea
this
was going on in my house.
I
mean, honestly. So I can definitely see where that's a frustration.
Yeah, that's very frustrating. And
to
have to go through and all that stress and trauma. And
for me, the writing the letters and stuff was cathartic, because I felt like I was doing something.
Right.
You know, I didn't want to just sit there. And they'll just tell. And it is the most important thing, is that your daughter or the victim is away from the perpetrator. But for me, that wasn't really enough. I wanted to see him because, you know, he was 48 years old at that time. So I can't imagine that she was his only victim.
Right.
I mean, I don't think he woke up one day and was like, okay.
And I think that's another important thing to consider. It's just that, you know, when a perpetrator is doing that, God knows how many other, you know, victims he's done that to.
That was a big motivation for my daughter. I would have her, you know, I know she didn't want to testify, but besides being empowering and really getting her story out there, by doing that, I would use examples of like her little cousin. Uh-huh. You know, like, you're helping these people because you're coming forward and you're putting him away. And,
right.
And without trying to put too big of a burden on her.
Uh-huh.
So I think that really helped.
Yeah.
I mean, I hope so.
Yeah, because in a way it's allowing the child to kind of seem like a superhero in a way, or protector, you know.
And you're taking back your power because this crime,
you
lose all your power.
Right.
There's someone that's, you know,
doing
things to you and you can't tell anybody. I mean, how terrible.
Yeah, and I think it's an amazing thing that you are working at Kids Talk now with all that knowledge, and you could do so much. So I think that's awesome. And I was just wondering if, like, you know, I feel like that there could be policies, updated policies, you know, in order to improve our, you know, criminal justice system and, you know, sexual assault cases, hopefully decrease. I mean, right now we have Aaron's Law, which is super helpful, because it, you know, the goal is to increase the number of school-based sexual abuse prevention programs and to give, you know, parents those resources about sexual abuse and to try to find, you know, warning signs and give teachers that awareness and school staff. And I think that that's super important. I think it's very beneficial.
I agree. I couldn't agree with you more. And honestly, education is key. Now, to be honest with you, I did talk to my daughter and my son about, you know, a good touch and a bad touch.
Uh-huh.
And I don't care who it is. You can tell me.
Right.
But they're just not going to tell if they've been groomed like that.
Uh-huh.
But the key with the education and the Aaron's Law is great is to get it in sooner. I'm
mm-hmm.
talking preschool, kindergarten.
Right.
Okay? Because you think you're protecting their innocence. They can handle that talk. That's,
uh-huh.
you know, what they can't handle is somebody abusing them.
Right.
Right?
Exactly.
So it makes a huge difference. And I hear a lot, well, they don't need to hear about that yet. Yes, they do.
Yes, because it
can
happen at any age. Yeah.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, the good thing about Aaron's Law and that policy that was created was, first of all, Aaron was a victim herself of trauma before she created this law and this policy. And so she thought of the many ways that, you know, what kids would need to hear while they were getting abused in order to actually go and tell someone. And so I think what you said, to have it in schools and then to have the parents know about it and to have, like, you know, school counselors know about it and have all those, you know, people around you talking about, you know, the effects of it and, you know, to speak up. I think it gives those students and those children a platform to be like, okay, I think it's time for me to say something. You know, all
Absolutely.
Of these people in my life are, you know, encouraging us
Absolutely.
To say something. Let me speak up.
It's absolutely, it's a great thing. And even I would even venture to say, I would hope before school age, maybe with their pediatrician.
Oh,
you know, maybe, because it's so... And especially, I mean, not so much with, like, a stranger assault, but with and 95% of the time, it's someone the child knows and trusts.
Right.
So you want to really put that element in there.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
I love your dad, but if your dad's making you uncomfortable, no, you can tell me. If you feel you can't tell me, go tell your grandma.
Uh-huh.
Tell your aunt. Tell your teacher. Tell your doctor.
Right.
Yeah, I wish I would have... What people really need to know is that it's only 4-6% of the time is it the creepy stranger in the van.
Right,
in the
exactly.
park. Okay.
Yeah.
It's usually someone that you know, and they've usually done it before. And a lot of times it's hidden through the family.
Yeah.
You know, and it's brushed under the rug because, you know, old Uncle Joey's a weirdo, or, you know, don't go around this neighbor because
right.
you kind of know about it, but nobody does anything about it. And
yeah.
I think we're really doing a disservice to our children.
Yeah,
I mean,
we are. And I think that you brought up a good point about, you know, maybe possibly bringing it up at, you know, in the pediatrician's office. And I think that the more that we start to have behavioral health consultants in these you know, centers and in these pediatrician offices and primary care, you know, offices, I think it's really important to, you know, possibly implement that and make that a policy where, you know, behavioral health consultants and pediatricians are required to bring it up to each family member
right.
and to educate them.
And I think the more we move into integrated care, like what we're doing, that,
that
will become more of a thing because we'll be
right.
working all together, especially if there's a mental health professional there as
right.
well.
Mm-hmm.
Also, as far as policies go, just a little side note, I know there are some places where they will allow the child to have a screen in front of them so mm-hmm. they don't have to face the accuser. And also there are some where the testimony is videotaped. But the problem with that is that the jury doesn't really get a feel, you know, with the two people in the room. So it's kind of a catch-22. You don't want to traumatize the child further by putting him on the stand and mm-hmm. having him be cross-examined, but do you want to put the person away? I mean, you know, in order to do that, it's always much better to have the child on the stand. Now, my daughter was 13, mm-hmm. so she could articulate, she could speak, you know. Now, you think about, like, a child that's 3 or 4. Mm-hmm. Those cases, very rarely.
Right.
They're very rarely are they even charged because there's not enough evidence. If they do go, they're usually pled out. Mm-hmm. If they're not pled out and they are like the 1% that makes it to trial, they usually get acquitted because, you know, 3, 4, you can't.
Right,
It's difficult.
And it's unfortunate.
Yeah.
And that's why I think it's, you know, that policy implication that we could possibly, you know.
Yeah. Well, there should be a policy in place, especially about a defense attorney crossing a child. You shouldn't be able to say to a child, like, well, why didn't you push him off you when the child weighs 30 pounds and the perpetrator weighs 200? You know, I mean, you shouldn't. I mean, because then the child is like, well, why didn't I? Why didn't I didn't try to stand there. You know, and
there's guilt and shame and self-blame.
So
and,
frustrating.
Yeah.
So frustrating.
There's a lot of, you know, consequences that come with that. And I think that it needs to be, you know, that should not be allowed in our criminal justice system. That should be, you know, illegal cross-examinations.
We're re-victimizing the victims.
Sexual assault.
Again,
right.
You know, not only have they suffered the trauma of sexual abuse, but now they're suffering the trauma of being not believed or mocked by it.
Yeah. But, so yeah, I think it's just really important. I know that, you mentioned that you have, you know, a victim statement that you wanted to, you know, include, and I think that that would be very empowering and important to include and to share with everyone. So,
I think that is a really big thing. I know it was for both of us. Because again, you get to speak directly to the perpetrator and to whoever else is in the courtroom without being interrupted. So I think it's almost the victim impact statement is a super, super important tool in healing.
I agree completely. Yeah. I think it's just a very empowering thing for the victim and their victim's family as well. So
yeah. I mean, my victim statement, I mean, I really kind of just put it together, but it kind of went with what I felt at the time. So mine is directed first to the perpetrator, and which, by the way, he was found guilty.
Yeah.
Sentenced to 25 years to life.
Oh,
so
nice.
He has a chance to be up for parole in 2039. Mm-hmm. And he's lifetime sex offender registry. He'll also have to wear an ankle monitor if he ever gets out. He'll be 78 at that time.
Oh, that's amazing. Wow.
So we're hoping that, you know, the justice system prevails.
And right.
So
that's amazing.
I'm just going to read this victim statement. This is just kind of a how I felt that day after we went to the sentencing and he was sentenced to this. So it's part of it's addressed to the judge and then the very last part is addressed to the perpetrator. Mm-hmm. So it goes something like this. It is difficult to find words that effectively describe the pain and heartache this person has inflicted on our family. Your Honor, his crimes, deceptively heinous, have shaken us to our very core. Our faith in the human race is irrevocably broken. No longer can we trust our ability to judge someone's character. I, as a mother, have gone over and over this in my mind, and I cannot fathom how I could have been so very, very wrong about a person. Your Honor, I would truly give anything not to be standing in this courtroom today facing this monster, a man I once loved, a man I trusted completely with my most precious commodity, my children. This person is the most dangerous of predators. He's not the creepy stranger in the van. What he is much, much worse. He ingratiates his way into your life, sneaky, manipulative, posing as a friend, a coach, a husband, and a father. Slowly, methodically, building trust, waiting for the opportunity to pounce. He attacked an innocent 8-year-old girl, a little girl who looked up to him and called him daddy. Wearing the mask of father by day and repeatedly maliciously forcing himself on her at night. Threatening and intimidating her, my daughter lived in a constant state of fear, always wondering would this be the night that he comes into my room? My daughter at such a young age endured what no child should ever have to experience. Her innocence is gone forever. The magic and wonder of childhood erased. While her friends played with dolls and made playdates, my daughter spent many of her days in a continuous state of anxiety, never knowing what would happen next. Childhood should be a place of love and comfort. Parents are supposed to protect their children, not harm them. Unfortunately, it is beyond the point of no return for my daughter's innocence. The damage is done. His acts, incomprehensible, and for what? To satisfy his own sick sexual perversion? I will never understand this. Throughout this entire ordeal, the perpetrator has not expressed 1 ounce of remorse. He's accepted zero responsibility for this disgusting crime he committed. In fact, the only thing he is sorry for is the fact that he got caught. He knows what he did, and he knows I know what he did. So I implore you, Your Honor, to impose the maximum sentence. He is a menace to society in the truest sense of the word. I plead with you to grant my daughter at least the peace of mind, knowing her molester will never get out of prison. One last thing she has to worry about as she navigates her way through the difficult road of healing. I ask you to give her comfort that he will never be able to hurt her or any other little girl again. Clearly, there are no winners in this courtroom today. My daughter certainly has lost the most. As her mother, I wish I could take her pain and bear it myself. I can't begin to imagine the burden of living with such an evil secret and being threatened that your mother or brother will die if she dared to tell. My son and I are not winners either. Our ability to trust other human beings forever altered. The perpetrator's own children must now grow up knowing that their father is a convicted child molester, and his mother must live with the burden that her son is a monster. The rest of this family, encased in the warm comfort of denial, to face the truth is too painful for them. As it happens all too often, they blame the victim. My children and I have been continuously harassed by these people who support a pedophile and turn their back on an innocent child. So again, there are no winners here today. A winning situation would be for this never to have happened. Tragically, it is all too real. I did not choose this. He made that choice for us, unwittingly thrust us into the bowels of humanity. Despite what happened to my daughter, my family and I will continue to push through the pain and betrayal until we make it to the other side. We catch glimpses of light at the end of the tunnel. It is in these flashes that we find hope. Fleeting, perhaps, but it does exist. Sorry. We refuse to let him take everything from us. In fact, this is all he will ever take. I will spend all my energy on my daughter's recovery, ensuring that she not only survives this, but thrives in spite of it. Your Honor, if because of my daughter's courage, coming forward, testifying in a full courtroom and facing her attacker, has saved another little girl and their family this heartache, then something positive has already come out of this awful tragedy. And you, perpetrator, I want you to know that you've stolen from us all that you ever will. It's over. We will not be allowing you another moment in our thoughts. My daughter, my son, and I will continue to rebuild and enjoy our lives. Part of our healing will include working to erase the stigma of this type of crime, exposing pedophiles like yourself, and putting an end to victim shaming, enabling more victims the empowerment to come forward. Thank you.
Wow. Sorry. That was powerful. Oh my gosh.
Sorry, I haven't read it in a long
time. I was crying.
Wow. Sorry, listeners. That was a little...
That was a lot. I'm sure. How do you feel after reading it after so long? Like, how did that feel?
Like, I go back and revisit it every once in a while.
Yeah.
It's been probably 2 or 3 years since I've read it.
Mm-hmm.
I was good in the beginning, and then it started to bring me back to that place.
Mm-hmm.
Which, like I said, if anything good comes out of that, then that it was worth it, but...
But imagine all the, you know, all the lives that you guys saved just from prosecuting him and putting him in jail for that long, like...
Right. I'm sure you guys have helped so many other lives and saved so many girls from going through such hardship and heartache and, you know, depression and all the things that come with sexual abuse. And I think it's it was really powerful to listen to that.
Well, thank you for giving me the chance to read that. That was a little tougher than I thought.
Yeah.
But I think it's something that at least can speak to other victims. And there is power in facing your accuser and having people bear witness to that.
Definitely. So, definitely, yeah. 100%. And I think just hearing that, even for me as a therapist who works in this type of work, is truly, like, I don't know, I think it's a little bit motivating for me just to feel like, okay, maybe I'm helping, hopefully, you and I are helping many, you know, children to come step up and their family members and to go through that process and process that trauma and all of that. So thank you for sharing that.
Well, thank you for listening. And I think even for me, I think it's really inspiring to see you do this kind of work, because you're young and you really, I had like a motivation behind me, you know, I saw it firsthand. So I felt like I wanted to do something because it touched me personally.
Right.
So for you to go forward and go into this awful, I mean, cause you've probably heard things even since we've been in field that you're like, wow, you know,
it's a lot.
Or at your other job that you worked. Yeah. It's a lot. It's a lot. But you know, at the end of the day, when we look at our clients, you know, or I look at my daughter, they're people, and something bad happened to them. It doesn't mean that they are bad or that they're ruined. I mean, you know, so we're working to change the stigma, I think, at least, right?
Right, and that's so powerful and empowering and amazing. And I think, you know, I know she was, you know, I know she offered to be interviewed and, you know, and so hopefully we'll be talking to her in a few minutes.
Yeah, sounds
and,
good.
You know, I think that was really, you know, courageous of her to offer, to speak.
She actually is very straightforward, which is really interesting. A lot of people are almost shocked by it. She's about to graduate from high school in a couple weeks, so it's been years, but she really has no trouble telling her story.
Yeah,
I hope you enjoy the interview with her. Don't cry too many tears, because we are doing well and there is recovery from this, but I think
it's good
key
to hear.
Prevention, education,
and
help if it happens.
Yep, definitely.
Okay, so I'm here with Alexa. She's graciously agreed to talk to us, and as I mentioned, she is a survivor of child sexual assault. So, Alexa, thanks again for coming and talking to us.
You're welcome.
Kind of want to talk a little bit about what you knew about sexual abuse before it happened to you. So would you say that you were pretty, you kind of knew, or you didn't know?
I wouldn't say I was uneducated, but I didn't know enough to know that it was wrong, that it was happening to me.
I see. So in your opinion, do you think then maybe we should start educating kids a little sooner and maybe with a little more information?
Yeah, I think that's very important to prevent it and to bring up past survivors and their past experiences.
I know a lot of people would say that they don't want their kids to know about that so young because it's kind of ruining their innocence. What would you say to any parent that would disagree with you on that, that they did not want their child to learn about sexual abuse early, let's say 4 or 5 years old?
That definitely your child can handle the talk about it, but the abuse itself is something that they're not going to be able to get through alone by themselves. And if they're uneducated and they aren't aware of what's wrong and what's right, they're not going to know, which could lead to future trauma and future problems.
I see, and I agree with you. And also we want to talk a little bit about, like, the legal system. So we know that the legal system moves a lot slower than we think it should. We tend to think of it as maybe Law and Order or CSI, where everything's wrapped up in an hour. Can you share a little bit of your frustrations with the legal system while we were going through the process of waiting for him to be charged and then going to trial?
It's hard not knowing what's going to happen, definitely. Not having any control over the situation that you're in. And having someone walk free like that is not easy either, knowing that they're in the same town as you and there's a chance of another little girl possibly going through what you're going through. Having to wait almost a year for trial, over a year, was not easy at all. Not getting justice right away is hard because you have to deal with it over and over every day until it's over.
Yeah. And in your case, which usually is very rare because they usually take a plea, the perpetrator actually went to a jury trial, so, and you had to testify in open court. Can you tell us just a little bit like what that was like for you and how you prepared yourself and how you were able to handle that because he was there?
I mean, there really was no preparation for that. The only thing I could really do is tell my story and tell the truth, and that was the only thing I could do. It was nerve-wracking telling my story to a room full of pretty much strangers, but most of it his family and a jury of strangers that were going to decide whether he was guilty or not.
Right. So then, luckily, he was convicted, and, can you tell a little bit how you felt when you heard the news that he was going to prison for 25 years?
It was relieving. It was like I'd finally like won my innocence back and won my childhood back. But it obviously didn't take it away and it didn't heal anything much.
So what would you say was the biggest factor in you starting to move through the healing process? I know you had a little bit of trauma-informed therapy with a counselor, and you had said you had some support, mainly from your family and your friends. Can you maybe give some specific things, maybe to help other people that really helped you move through this process?
Definitely telling yourself every single day that it's not your fault and that you aren't alone. There's, sadly, plenty of people who have been through the same thing, and there's support groups out there, and there are people who understand what you're going through, no matter what you think. And having a family and having friends that do understand and support and believe you is the only thing that really helped me through it.
Gotcha. Would you say that even to this day that it makes you feel better talking to other people who have been through similar things? Or do you not really come into contact with that many people that have gone through this?
I'm sure I come into contact. I'm just not aware of it.
Right. Well, I know in the beginning, when your story first came out, like even in school and like amongst maybe friends or people that have knew you, kind of reached out and shared their story with you.
Yeah, and that was what kind of made me realize that this was a lot more common than I thought it was, and that I really wasn't the weird girl that I thought I was all through all of elementary school, and I wasn't as abnormal as I thought, and that this happens, it's normalized a lot more than it should be.
Right.
And it happens a lot more than it should.
Right. And I know even some of those people had never told anybody until they told you. And I think that was probably really helpful for them and really cathartic for them to have you as like a person that so publicly told your story.
And that's why I still do it. I mean, because you never know who you can help one day.
That is true. And speaking of like a child advocacy center where Rania and I work right now, you said you can't remember much of the forensic interview. Obviously, it was very daunting and it happened right in the beginning. But as a whole, would you say that that is a good idea to have a place where you can safely tell your story with these people instead of telling it over and over again? Maybe tell it once, because I know you're... tape is shared with like the prosecutor and the defense attorney, so you don't have to keep telling your story.
Yeah, and I definitely think it's a good idea that it's like one person and it's not a group of older people talking to a younger girl or boy like about what happened to her. It's a lot more relaxing to know that like you're not all eyes are on you, but
just made it a little bit easier for you to tell what happened to you. Yeah. Well, again, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your story with us. You've been very brave throughout this, and I know you're getting ready to go off to college in the fall. So what do you think you want to do with your life nowadays, now that you've went through this and you've come out and emerged a really strong survivor and advocate for sexual abuse, sexual assault? What do you think you want to do with that?
With that, like, specifically, I want to be a prosecuting attorney because I want to get justice for these people, and I want people to see what I saw that day. Like, I think that's important. And also, I think that, like, social work would be good because I'm experienced. So, I mean, not experienced, but I have experience with the trauma, and I could help people cope through it. And I do understand where they're coming from, whether my case is as bad or as not as bad. But everyone carries that same guilt and that same trauma. So,
right. And I think that's really important, too, working in this field. Like, if you feel... if you can really feel and empathize with somebody, like you said, it might not be the exact same trauma, but they can at least get a sense that you kind of know what you're talking about and you kind of have an idea maybe what they're going through. I think that's really helpful.
Yeah. And it's a lot easier to help somebody when you understand what they're going through, obviously.
Right.
It's a lot easier to see through their advice.
I agree. Well, thanks again for coming in, and we wish you a successful graduation and college career and beyond. If you had any advice for someone that's going through this right now and has not told anybody, what would you say to them?
I'm not going to tell you to tell your mom or your dad, but tell a trusted adult for sure. Somebody that you know is going to believe you, and somebody that you know will get you the help that you need. And fight for justice, fight for that back, because I mean, it's too big of a part of you to take away that somebody else could take away from you to not win it back. So I'd say fight for it, for sure. And just keep winning for justice and hoping for justice.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice. Okay, well, thank you again for talking to us and letting us interview you. Is there anything else that you want to add?
No.
No? Okay. Well, thank you very much.